Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Two Norries podcast. I am your host, James. I'm not joined, as always, by my good friend, Timmy Long.
Hi, everyone.
Rosalind O'Callaghan is our guest today. How are you, Rosalind?
I'm good, thanks. And yourselves?
Not too bad. Well. Not too bad. So you were on the telly recently with Katie Hannan.
I was. I was on RT Up Front with Katie Hannan a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
Yes.
Talking about your experience of abuse in the Defence Forces.
Of my rape experience while I was serving overseas with the 83rd Infantry Battalion UNIFIL.
Okay.
In 1998.
Yeah. Before we get into that, bring us back to where you're from and what it was like growing up for you.
Yeah. I'm from Bandon, born in St. Finbarr's in 1977 and born and reared in Bandon in Richmond Court, council estate, five of us in the family, mum and dad, and had a good childhood, yeah.
And had you got a family member in the Defence Forces?
I did. My mother's father, my grandfather, and my mum's two brothers, Raymond and Jimmy. Jimmy's nickname was Number 7. The three of them served with the 11th Battalion and the 1st Field Artillery Regiment in Ballincollig.
So it must have been, for you, sure, it must have been a dream to join the army.
I always wanted to be a soldier. I wanted to follow my grandfather's footsteps. Mother and my nan thought I was mad, but I did it.
Yeah. And back then, for a female in the army, were there few to be seen? Was it a period of time where there was a number of females starting to join the army? Yeah. Or was it just overpopulated with men at the time?
Oh, it's still overpopulated with men. But at the time, women were joining the army, but it wasn't kind of the done thing, But from what I know is that I joined in 1996, December 96. We were the 80th recruit platoon. Yeah. And there were 7 females joined in the platoon of 30.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's still a good number for the time, was it?
For the time, yeah, it was.
Would there be more now?
There would. But at the time, the selection process was very hard. You had to go through an interview process, then you had to go through a fitness test, and then you had your medical. And I remember the fitness test. Oh, God. I can't run. I still can't run. Mm. But I passed it and I passed the medical, and then I was one of the 7 that got into the platoon.
It must have been absolutely thrilled, I'd say. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I couldn't believe it. This is where I wanted to go in life. That was my path. And I went in as a recruit. I did in 1998.
What was it like when you went in?
I was in the FCA before that, so I had an idea of how, drills and marching and uniform and dress. And
you describe a typical day for a private.
as a private?
As a recruit or as a private. You're learning the ropes. What's a typical day for you?
In training, I suppose I'd go with recruit training. You have to get up early in the morning. You probably, you'd set your alarm for maybe 6 a.m. so that you can get your boots ready. Well, they should have been ready anyways from the night before. Mm-hmm. Your uniform has to be immaculate, ready for inspection. Your bed has to be dressed down you know, folded immaculately, and all yourself, your own personal hygiene has to be immaculate, and the toilets, the showers, the stairs, floors, no dust, everything had to be spotless. Yeah. And then you go out on parade, you're marched to breakfast, you get breakfast, then you come back and you get ready for inspection on the square, where they inspect your clothing, yourself and your clothing, your boots, and after that you might do a few some marching skills around the square in Collins Barracks, and after that then you go up and there'd be a room inspection. And after that then you'd have drill inspection when it comes to weapons. You're learning about the Steyr and the GPMG, and yeah, and then you would have your fitness routine where you're taking on physical training, you know, runs, that would be miles.
Miles. In the army, right, you have these sergeants, these guys that are doing the drills, and they're screaming and roaring into your face. You know the way you watch it on TV. And I've often been looked at and I said, I don't think I could actually take that. Him calling you this, that and the other and screaming into your face and spitting and calling you. How do you deal with that? How does another human being deal with someone in their face like that?
Is it like that?
Yes. Well, back in my day it was. Not so much now. But back in 1998, 1999, yes, it was. But you just have that mental strength where you just block it out. And you just take it on the chin.
Even Hell Week, when we were watching Hell Week there a few months ago. Do you see this? Someone's shouting and roaring.
Try to push your buttons, like, back at the lads.
But that's what they do.
Try to break you.
And did that ever get to you? Did it ever get to you to a stage that you said, I can't do this anymore?
No, not that way. I suppose I was on a training course. It's called a non-commissioned officer's course. And in 2002, and it's for promotion. So you'd be promoted corporate. But the course is 6 months long and it's intense and it's physical and it's mentally draining. Yeah, and I remember I lost so much weight. I went down to 7 stone. Yeah. But we were on a tactical exercise at the time up in Kilworth, and the pressure was on us, so, you know, and this NCO training instructor came right up to my face, like that, and started roaring, "Oh, Callan, problem, my low curse." And next thing I just, eyes up to heaven, he said, "Are you rolling your eyes at me for?" And I just said, "Off, like, I couldn't take any more." No, he broke me. Now he did, you know. And he actually reported it and everything after, like, I got bottling all over, but you just take it on the chin and get on with it again, you know.
It's learning in it for you,
So at the beginning, everything was grand, you were enjoying the army, you were joining. When did things start to become difficult for you?
So I was selected to go overseas in 1998, and I went with the 83rd Infantry Battalion, UNIFIL, and I was in the communications section, signal section, so I was signaller private. And I had just turned 21, and a few weeks later, anyway, we were getting kind of a night off. And we were told, you know, do you want to go to the next base for a night out and have a few drinks and just to chill and relax? And of course we did. And there was a couple of us girls, and it was a chance for us to kind of get out of our uniform as well and get into shorts and T-shirt. But even though it was called a beach party, it wasn't a case of where you're getting into your bikini or your togs, or the men were getting into their trunks or their shorts. It wasn't that kind of a party. Yeah. It was just called a beach party for the sake of it.
Yeah.
So,
Take your time.
So, So we changed out of our uniform. We got into our civilian attire, as they call it. You know, that's their army terms.
Yeah.
And I got into my white top and I had shorts on, denim shorts and runners and had a few drinks, Tea Maria milk at the time. Oh, God, I couldn't. How did I do it? I don't know. And then there was beer as well, Almaza and Heineken. And I had a lot to drink. I had a lot to drink, but I was still having a good time with the girls. And I remember towards the end of the night, then I can't handle drink.
Yeah.
Even to this day, if I was drunk after a night out, I would end up vomiting on the side of the bed at home,
yeah,
you know, or into the toilet bowl.
Yeah.
But that night in question, I went outside of the bar, I suppose, as you call it, and I started vomiting. And one of the girls came out and saw the condition I was in. But it was near time to go back to base anyway, to our own accommodation. So we mounted the CISU. So CISU is an armoured vehicle that carries troops in the back of it. So we got into that. I suppose I was put into it, you know, and I had to be held up. And got back to base. And I was throughout the whole journey back, I suppose it was about a half an hour. Throughout the whole journey back, I was vomiting into my green issue bag. I had clothes, my uniform and everything in it. And plus the vomit. So the girls took me to my room in the Cygnus block in Camp Shamrock. And there was always a problem with the bloody lock that I had, but I was the only one that could just kind of open it.
Yeah.
But the girls couldn't do it that night. And of course, me in the state I was in, I couldn't do it either. So directly across the corridor, 2-3 feet, one of the girls put me into her room and into her bed. And I'm told that I was put to bed fully dressed. And my shoes were, my footwear was taken off. And I just went out cold then. Mm. I was put on my side and the blankets put over me. And so the girls left me there. They went to their own rooms then. And the girl that I was sharing the room with that night, she gave me her bed, but she had to sleep on the floor. But she decided she was going to phone home. So that's what she did. She went into the bunker, which was about 7 or 8, 9 feet away. And what you go into the bunkers when you come under fire.
Mm.
And there's a phone in there as well, and you're able to phone home. So that's what she did. Now, I don't know how long she was in there. So so that night in July,
take your time.
I woke up to this man on top of me and taking my shorts off and my underwear, kissing me and raping me. And from the, I describe it as I was having an out of body experience. I knew there was something happening, but I couldn't stop it. I knew something wrong was seriously happening. And I always, even to this day, described it as if there was an angel. I don't know, this probably sounds weird, like it's like an angel saying, "Rosin, wake up, there's something happening." And I couldn't. I was in and out, passing in and out of consciousness.
Yeah.
You know, drink, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And how long he was there, I don't know. How long was he raping me? I don't know. And I remember the door opening again. I think he went away and came back. I don't know, did he rape me again? But I do remember him saying, "Ross, Ross, I just want to talk to you. I just want to talk to you." And I said, "Go away, leave me alone. Just go away and just leave me alone." And I passed out again.
Let's just clarify for some of our listeners that you gave him no indication that there was anything romantic going on at any stage during this period of time.
No, no. He was a senior NCO. And
what's an NCO?
A non-commissioned officer. Okay. He was a senior non-commissioned officer.
What does non-commissioned
mean? So you have commissioned who are officers, and then you have non-commissioned who are not officers.
Okay.
And that's, you've got them and you've got us.
Oh, I see. Do you know when you woke up and he was there, did you recognise him? Was it a familiar face or was it too blurry? Or
it was blurry, and it was the voice, and it was kind of in and out, blurriness. But I suppose getting back to your question, Timmy, is I had no dealings with this person whatsoever. I knew him from working in the camp only. I wouldn't have had any communications with him. I wouldn't have had any, how would I put it, relationship with him, you know. And it was a case of just hello, goodbye, you know. And that was it on my side. But he had other things to say.
How do you think that that he was able to see you in that kind of condition? Was it a case that when you came back to base that you were spotted in that kind of condition, drunk condition?
He was actually in the SISU with us, okay, on the way to the party and on the way back from the party, but he wasn't in our social scene. So he would have seen clearly the condition I was in the back of the SISU. And I'm told from reliable girls that he took my green bag away to clean it out. And when he brought it back, he was told that I was asleep in the room and not to go in and to leave the bag at the veranda, on the veranda.
So it was opportunistic on his point.
He saw a target.
Yeah.
And he
took his chance.
He striked.
Yeah. What was it like when you woke up, when you sobered up?
I woke up between 5:30 and 6:15 the next morning. And
did you know straight away what was after happening, or did you wake up and then you got a flashback?
Yeah, flashback. I sat up in the bed and I looked around.
And then that hit you.
And I went, I was naked from the bottom half down, and my bra strap was opened, but it was still on with my white top still on. Oh, I'm getting shivers now. And I saw the girl on the ground, and I'm sure I can say her name, Valerie. And I took her big coat and I put it on me, and I went out of the room. My head was spinning, you know, when you're.
Yeah.
And I went over to the room and I got the fucking key to open, like, excuse my language. And I went in and I went, did that happen? Am I imagining this? Was I dreaming this? But I have no clothes on from here down. My bra is opened. And I sat on the bed and I was like, what am I going to do? How am I going to... Could I be pregnant? Do I need the morning after pill? I've done nothing wrong here. And I was saying, was I raped? Did that just happen to me? And that's when I contacted two officers, two captains. And they came to my room and I told them what had happened. And
that was on the same day.
That was on the same morning, yeah. Within minutes of I reporting it. And the female captain said, I know, Roz, you probably don't want to hear this, but what you're after telling me I can tell you now, but from the way you're after describing it, you have been raped. And that's when you hit, you go, from that moment on, the lights, I describe it as the lights went out. My soul left my body and I wasn't this chirpy young 21-year-old, had her whole career in front of her, you know, had opportunities. The lights went out and I became just Roslyn. My soul left my body and I just became numb.
How did the camp feel after that? No, I don't know how much time you had left in the camp before you were actually going to be heading back to Ireland after your mission. But how long more did you have to stay in the same camp together, and what was the environment, that attention?
Yeah, in the camp, I had 3 months left of my trip. The environment became very, I'll use the words, raw and hostile and divided. Became very divided because, you know, he was going around telling his side of the story and denying everything. And there I am going through trauma, I suppose, and shock. And I had to go through the experience of being forensically tested in Nahari in Israel. And that was hard.
When something happens like that in the Irish camp, is it the Lebanese authorities deal with it, or how does that work?
No. It's our own military police, our own Irish military police. Yeah. They had no rape kit in the camp. So it had to be arranged that I be taken to Nahari in Israel in the back of a military ambulance to be forensically examined. Mm-hmm. So I had to keep what was on me. And even before I got into the ambulance, there was military police everywhere up in the outpatients department, looking for statements, and I was in Nuffield State at that time.
So when you told the two captains initially, you were believed by that lady?
Yes, or I was, yeah.
Were you believed by both captains?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know, James.
Did you say anything?
I actually don't know.
Yeah. What about home? Did you ring anybody at home?
So a few days had passed and... A few days had passed and no one had contacted my parents. So they were waiting for me to do it. So there was no liaison officer had contacted my mum and dad. And my unit in the 4th Infantry Battalion in Connells Barracks didn't even know. And I remember being in this tiny room and there was filing cabinets. And back then, in 98, they had the satellite phones, you know,
yeah.
Big chunky ones. I was brought in, I was told, you know, dial the number and ring home. I tell you, lads, that was the hardest, most distressful time telling, you know, explaining. How do you explain to your mum and dad?
Exactly. How does, what kind of reaction?
Sure, God, like, are they supposed them, to have? I don't know how they reacted, but it must have been devastating for them. And then for me to hang up the phone and they're just left in limbo.
Yeah, and they can't do nothing.
And my poor mum, you know, and my poor dad, I'm thousands of miles away in another country and that's it. You have to tell them that your eldest daughter has been raped.
Jesus Christ.
Was there ever any, going back to the movies, if there's a crime committed in the Defence Forces, they have, an internal, process where there's a court-martialing and there's a hearing, and was there anything like that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there was, yeah. There were statements taken from witnesses. So a few weeks later, I was informed that this individual was not going to be charged with rape, that there's not enough evidence to suggest that he raped me forensically or through witness statements, you know. So the morning of the charge, they're called charges, so the morning that he was going to be charged, I had to get into my best uniform, my best kit, and I remember walking across the tarmac in Camp Shamrock and heading towards the battalion commander's office with the female captain. And I was actually anxious and I felt sick, and because I knew he was going to be there. So I remember I really didn't want to go in there, and if I refused to go in there, I would have been charged under some section as well. So I had to gather myself, and shaking out with nerves, and I was marched in. And when I stood to attention, stood to attention next to him like this, you know, and I would have been here, and he would have been right here, so we could have touched hands.
Jesus Christ.
No, bearing in mind, lads, that this is the man that raped me.
I know.
And I'm stood, they won't even do it in the court of law, no. Anywhere.
It's like the opposite to trauma and foreign practice. Like, there was no realisation what it must have been like for you. Like.
No. And before the colonel asked or went ahead with the charges, starting the charges, he says, I said, sir, I need to say something here. And that's kind of something that's not done, you know. And I said, sir, I said, that man, like that, I said, that man raped me. And he replied, that's not the issue here, Private O'Callaghan. Do you want a seat to sit down? So they would have got a seat for me to sit down right next to him. And I said, no. And have you anything to say? And I said, that man raped me. He said, that's not the issue here. And Grammer Shaw left out the door and I broke down crying into the female officer's hands, arms. And I said, I just want to go home. I can't do this no more.
Do you know when this happened and afterwards, were you expected to go back working as normal? Or did they give you, did they leave you stay in your room to kind of get yourself together for a few, I don't know. So did you stay for the extra 3 months after that?
No, I didn't. Once I fell into the female officer's arms, I said, I want to go home. So you have to go through a repatriation process. But that night, I remember going over to the room and I was on my own. And at that time, this was a few weeks later. At that time, I didn't have many friends. I could count on one hand how many supported me. And I will never forget those girls and the men as well. There was a few men, but the next day, we were told we had to clean our weapons. So I stripped the stire down, I started cleaning it, and then I realised, oh, fuck, I have no mechanism in it. So the mechanism is a
pin.
It's the mechanism, that's what makes the weapon fire.
Mm.
Where the fuck is the mechanism, like, you know? Anyway, I started panicking, and I went to my company sergeant, and he said to me, we have that. We were afraid in case you do something to yourself. Yet they left me travel back home to Ireland on my own.
When you got home to Ireland, was there more of a formal practice to what was after happening, or was that it?
That was it.
That what happened?
That was it. I went back to my unit.
And that was it?
That was it.
It was never spoke about again?
Oh, you would get a yarish.
Yeah.
But that was it. It was never talked about.
Well, if it happened in Ireland, in one of the barracks in Ireland, do the army still investigate internally, or is the guards brought in?
The guards are brought in now, James.
Back then it was like...
Back then it was just military police.
Investigating themselves.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm.
Yeah.
So there's a army version of GSOC. which is the Garda Sergeant, the Garda Ombudsman. They investigate externally and independently from the guards. Does something like that now for the army?
Yes, yeah. And it's quite frightening, really, because, you know, my opinion is that I wasn't taken seriously and there was a lot of cover-ups, and I still believe that. And the investigation was flawed from start to finish, and it was just riddled with lies and cover-ups.
Let's go back to the court that you were in the barrack, and when you were told that that's not the issue here. That doesn't make sense to me. Like, what was this judge saying? That's not the issue here. What were you doing
so
in there?
So he wasn't even a judge, Timmy. So he would have been this colonel, a really senior officer. So he would have taken his instructions from, say, the legal officers back home in Ireland and out there in Lebanon.
What was the issue? Why were you actually inside in the...
Yeah, I tell you. Yeah, yeah. Good question. He was charged for engaging in sexual conduct, I still remember it, for engaging in sexual conduct, for being in a female's room. And he was fined £175 and given a severe reprimand. Now, severe reprimand is only words. Mm. And it's only words on paper. It meant feck all.
Okay. That was it.
That was it.
Did you ever have any dealings with him afterwards?
No. Never, never, never. He was removed from camp from the moment I reported him.
Do you know when you got home and you went back into your company, and was there any support there from you from it's okay to say the army, is it?
Yeah.
So from the army in relation to maybe some counselling or anything to that nature?
To be fair, I suppose it was offered, but I was always of the belief and the opinion that I've done nothing wrong here now. And I'm going to hold my head up high and I'm going to get on with things. You're not going to drive me out of the army. I'm going to show ye that I can still soldier. Yeah. But it was very hard. I remember the first day I went out on parade in 4th Battalion and I got pulled because I had a big Overseas Ireland flash on my uniform, and there was some smart comment passed to me and we were dismissed off parade, and I just went into the girls' ladies' toilets and I actually collapsed to the floor, and I think that's when I realised I'm actually in trouble here mentally.
Yeah. And how did you go up?
I suffered in silence, Timmy.
Did you have anybody to speak to?
You couldn't trust anyone. I didn't trust anyone.
Did you drink?
I did. I turned to drink, yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Yeah, I turned to drink. So when I came home, when I was repatriated, I actually went to the Garda Síochána to report him.
Yeah.
And they came back to me saying nothing could be done because it was outside of the Irish jurisdiction. so nothing could be done to him. But I did, you know, they do have his name. They should have his name, where he's from, and it should be on file. So then I went to my solicitor, and she went through the whole legal aspect of things. Brought in a barrister, got legal advice, and at the end of the day, it came down to where we could have tried to have taken a court case, but I'd have to come up with thousands and thousands of euros at the time, which I didn't have. And the likeliness of me winning the case was extremely, extremely low.
So all this happened within the first 2 years of your army?
90, yeah, two, 3 years, yeah.
So you had another 20 years left in the army?
Yeah.
It takes a really strong human being to be able to to stay.
Do you think? I don't know.
I do think so.
Who drove on, like, do you know what I mean? Who didn't let that time drive you out of the army? You know, you still pursued it.
A lot of people would probably move away because of the constant reminder of seeing maybe that person. Now, as you said, they probably weren't in the environment that you were in, but still, you had to kind of look at different kind of people that were there, and it was bringing up stuff for you consistently.
Absolutely, and it did. I mean, I became so paranoid. I, you know, you couldn't say boo to me, and I'd end up in an emotional wreck. You know, and like it came down to anxiousness, anxiety, like stress, even to the point, you know, I was so paranoid about myself, the way I looked, the way I dressed. If someone was staring at me, I'm going, is there something wrong? You know,
yeah.
What are you looking at? But there wouldn't be, you know, there'd be no harm in it at all. But I couldn't function anymore. Yeah. I was just going with the flow.
Yeah.
But I suppose getting back to trying to get him through the courts here in Ireland, then is that okay if I go back to that?
Yeah,
is
of
it?
Course.
Yeah.
Of course.
So our only way that I could get him to admit some bit of liability, even though he still to this day hasn't, he offered me £10,000 for counselling. Now, lads, if you were innocent boys, you wouldn't be offering up £10,000 back then, would you?
Oh, absolutely not.
You know? But that was without admittance of liability.
Yeah.
I took the money because it gave me maybe some bit of closure. Not even closure, but some bit of him, admittance by him. If he was an innocent man,
yeah,
I'm an innocent man. He wouldn't have handed over that money, and that was a lot of money back then.
Oh, yeah, jeez, we're talking about pounds.
And I hated taking that money.
Of course,
I hated it.
But it was probably in your own head as well. At the same time, you knew that you were never going to get anything else.
I couldn't get any more out of him because apparently he didn't have it.
You were never going to get any more anything else because the case was already after being dealt with. You were never going to get justice in any other way.
No. And my well-being never came into it.
So for the next, so you stayed in the army for another 20 years, okay? We were chatting beforehand. No, right. You went back overseas two more times after that.
I did, yeah.
How difficult was that? Did the army look at you as probably, what's the right word here, James? There could have been an issue because of what happened already. Was that a difficult process for you to go back overseas? Because I know going overseas for a lot of people in the army, it can be financially rewarding for them as well. And I know it's a big deal for a lot of people because it might help them to get a mortgage, it might help them to buy a car or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
So what was the process of you getting back overseas after something like that?
Well, I, out of my stubbornness again, I soldiered on and I wanted to continue on with my career and I wanted to go up the ladder, you know, and... But Was it too soon to go back overseas? It probably was at the time. Now I can say it probably was. But I went back over. And I have no doubt that, you know, the senior officers probably had their doubts as well. Mm. And then you had people who, you know, were cautious. I'll use the word cautious. You know, stay away from her. She's trouble. And they, you know, it was lousy, really, when I think about it at the time. And
sounds very like you were in a really lonely place.
Like I remember in B Company on my second trip overseas, and this male NCO came up, and he was actually drunk, and he says, "I know everything in your personal file, even down to your medical records." And I'm like, "What?" And then I'm like, "I can't open my mouth here now because I'd be seen as a troublemaker again."
Yeah,
you know. But I did. I told someone, and sure, just have to get on with it.
Yeah.
But that's the way you were spoken to as well. But after that trip, then I came home. I did a full trip, and I came home, and that's when everything started to go wrong with me. That's when my mental health started suffering and started going downhill.
What age were you then?
23.
And you're suffering with your mental health.
23, yeah. I attempted suicide.
Okay, and this is probably 98, 99.
It was 99, 2000.
And we didn't have a lot of mental health services back here at that time.
No.
We didn't have very much at all. And if you were suffering with your mental health, you were put into the likes of maybe St. Anne's.
That's right, yeah. You
know, and I've been there myself a few times.
I've actually been inside there myself because when I was 13 years of age, I was told that my mum had a child when she was 18. So you're talking 60s,
yeah,
late 60s, and that child was taken off my mum. She was forced to hand her over. Family reasons back then, shame on the family, church, you know, lads, the whole, you know, those times. Yeah. But when Michelle turned 21, my mum found her after searching for her, and she was in St. Anne's. Mum never knew that Michelle had special needs when she was born. Yeah, so I know what you're saying about St. Anne's, because I've actually been in there. Yeah. I've seen the locks, I've seen the keys, and I've seen the environment, and I've seen the facilities.
So what did it take for you to get the help you needed with your mental health?
So to me, so I attempted suicide. I went to the shop. Back then you could buy loads of paracetamol. No, you're only limited to one packet, I think, And I must have taken 20, 30 of them. And I was admitted then to CUH. It was called Cork Regional Hospital then, wasn't
That's
it?
Right.
Yeah. And I was pumped. Yeah. And
How did you feel? How low were you?
I was at the darkest moments of my life because I just wanted people to believe me. And to know that I was suffering in silence, but still trying to function and trying to do my daily tasks, get up and go to work. I had enough. I had everything. I had the car, I had the money, I had the job.
Just wanted a way out.
Couldn't hold down a relationship. No one wanted to be bothered with me. You know, I was trouble.
How was your trust around men as well after something like that happened? Yeah.
Well, you had men that just didn't want to know me. My trust, all I wanted to me was to be loved, to be accepted.
I was a young girl,
you know. I came from Bandon as well, so moving up to the city was, you know, just different life altogether.
Different,
you know. I mean, you had the nightclubs and. Yeah.
Like when you grew up in Bandon, Bandon was country. Like estates, it was country, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You know, the old roads back down to Bandon. There was no dual carriageways to Bandon back then.
No. Yeah. Still a good town though. Yeah. You know, and good people are still in it.
It's in a beautiful area.
Yeah.
Down around there, you have you have Kilbritton, you have Clan, Roscarbery.
Yeah.
Not Roscarbery.
No, Inchidani. Inchidani. Yeah.
So it's a beautiful area.
It is, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
What, and do you know, with your girlfriends now, what way, how did they receive you? Or were they supportive for you? And
yeah. Two very close friends, yeah. And I'm ashamed to say that when, even though I was suffering from PTSD, I didn't know at the time, I shut them all out of my life. And I blame my mental health at the time. And I understand now that that was my mental health. And I'm ashamed to say that I blocked them out. I tried to focus on getting them back in my life. But I'd say they probably just, you know, yeah. I don't know. Like,
did you reconnect with them after?
We did. We did a few times, but there hasn't been any contact in years. Yeah.
Do you know, sometimes
I blame myself there.
Yeah.
Do you know, sometimes things like that do happen and you just have to move on.
I know.
You just have to move on. But listen, today, like you retired from the army after when it was time to retire, and you were on Katie Hannan recently.
Yeah.
And you explained your story. How was that received? How were you both received by the public, and how were you both received by the army and the representatives of the army? How did that go down?
So I'm with the group, the Women of Honour, and I would have been with that group since it was formed a few years ago, but I remained, I suppose, the silent one in the background, and because I just wasn't ready to tell my story. So the time was right, and I went on Katie Hannan's show a few weeks ago, and I was a nervous wreck, you know. Now it was going to be a time that I was exposing myself to the nation and to the world. Yeah. You know, you're on RTE. Yeah. And I was a nervous wreck, but I have to say, and it's been phenomenal, the support that I have received from people I know and from people I don't know.
Mm.
The kindness and the generosity. I've had flowers sent to my home.
Beautiful.
You know, I've had gifts, chocolates, and, you know, just pure kindness.
Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah.
Because you're starting to, I know you had a difficult time,
right?
But now you're seeing the real beauty in human beings.
Yes.
And I love that too.
Yeah.
Because when people can see themselves in another human being, they start to release the love within them.
Yeah.
You know, and they can feel your pain. And I'm sure a lot of people felt your pain when you were on the television and you were talking about your story, and people felt it. You know I would anyway, and I know James wouldn't, and I know Brian would, but and that's why that happened.
Yeah, and not only that, but I had people telling me their inner secrets, their most deepest secrets that they told no one, and now they're telling me, and I took great pride in that, because I know the pain that they experienced and probably still are experiencing, because, you know, like I get triggers. I could get triggers every day with the PTSD. I got a trigger yesterday and I was crying my eyes out all day. For what? But, you know, because I wasn't sleeping properly the last few weeks and it just got too much for me. But then you have to kind of ground yourself.
Mm.
And
like when you're putting yourself out there and you're talking about such a really delicate story like yours, okay, you're really leaving yourself wide open to everybody's feedback, critical feedback and positive. Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's real, you have to mind yourself. I mean, James, not as better than anybody. Mm. You know, you have to really, really mind yourself. And that period of time is really tough.
Yeah,
do you know that tough where from when you do this interview, it goes out into the public and you're like,
oh,
you're wide open.
Yeah, you're like
everything.
Yeah,
so you have to really, really mind everything that's going on for you
You know, like for years, I would have just, I would describe it now, I had a wall in front of me, you couldn't break that wall. Yeah. You know, I was letting no one in. No one. And slowly, through rehab and therapy, I've been in therapy for 4 years with the same therapist, Dr. Emmett Stones, just an outstanding doctor. He's patient with me, you know, because there was times and I just didn't want to cooperate with him. I thought, fuck this shit, like,
yeah, yeah.
I don't, you know, easy. This is, I go home and go, oh, he knows too much about me now, you know. But he stuck with me and I stuck with him, and you know, he taught.
It's like peeling the layers of an armor off. It's like just slowly.
Yeah.
See, that armor that we have, we carry that to protect us, and we build that up in years and years and stuff. I know it because of my own story. But in order for us to get well, you have to peel it back, and to peel it back, you have to start to trust people. But you also have to start to accept the shit that's after happening in your life, you know, and you have to start loving yourself and caring for yourself. And you also have to go back to that time where that traumatic event happened to you and mine in my own life, and I have to love that person back then. And you have to be there for them, because
I'm
sure.
Very hard to me.
I know it's very hard. I know. But if you, it's obvious that when that happened to you, that was a really difficult period in your life, okay? That you were not able emotionally for what went on, okay?
No.
And you weren't able to grieve for yourself at that period of time. So what we do is in therapy is we go back to them periods of time in our life and we grieve with a therapist and we process. And instead of hating that human being that we were back then and saying, fuck, you shouldn't let that happen to you, or whatever, you start to love that person.
Yeah.
You start telling that person, it's okay, I'm here now. This adult is here now to help you, to bring you along, to love you, to care for you, and to have some compassion and empathy for you.
But you also, you get your downsides too, because when I started therapy, I was going home and I remember the nightmares were starting to start again, the flashbacks were starting. I'd have nightmares at night and the rapist would be looking down at me and laughing at me. I could see him laughing at me in my in the nightmares, you know. I remember even the school collections, driving the car. Now I know we all go into another world, but this was like, I just keep driving and I'd forget to collect my child from school. Even though I got into the car to go up to the school to collect her. It was bad.
You just have a story in your head.
Yeah.
You know, you lose complete concentration.
Yeah, it was so, so bad. And again, like, I mean, I was diagnosed with PTSD, severe PTSD in 2001. But I was never told or treated by the army. So, in 2016, I realised that I actually need help. I can't, now is the time to actually say, Roslyn, you're not well. Mm. You need to speak up and you need to admit you need help.
So you were diagnosed with PTSD in the army, but they never actually told you?
No, never told or never treated. No, and it's in writing. I had a severe PTSD. And that was diagnosed by a medical psychiatrist, an army psychiatrist. So, and I was sent back overseas after that as well, that diagnosis, where I was repatriated from home or from Kosovo. Simple reason was I was triggered too many times out there. We were sharing showers with men. There was just a curtain between us. I could get out of the shower and you have fella go to the toilet and your urinal just right next to you, you know. And the accommodation, I suppose I didn't get on with the female that was in my room either. She probably, I don't know, I just didn't get on with her. And I got repatriated after a month in Kosovo.
So today in your life, we spoke beforehand, you have kids.
Three beautiful
kids.
You
have three kids and I'm sure by the time you met your husband and Mark, they came into your life, like your life started to change. You started seeing some value in your life. You started to feel maybe love because of the kids and stuff. How did your life change when you met your husband and your kids started?
When I met Mark, actually it's funny, lads, because it's not funny actually. When myself and Mark started dating, Mark was a sergeant in the army. When we started dating, he was actually warned. He was kind of approached and told, "What are you doing with her? She's trouble. Stay away from her." Mm. But Mark was a bigger man.
He's a Norrie.
He is. He's from Rathbeacon Road.
He's farmery man, not far away from us at all.
But I got the Norrie. Don't abandon, like.
He's a man, I'd say, that likes the countryside.
Actually does. We have two dogs. We have a Cocker Spaniel and a Westie, and we go down to the local river. I don't. Mark would put on the boots and let the little lads off. Oh God, Mark likes it. Yeah, but see, we have all the beaches around us as well. So, yeah, but he's always like he's in Enniscarry now tonight coaching. Like so, God, he's involved with the GAA as well. I was telling James that.
He played in a golden era on the pair sheet with John Gardner and Sean Og and all the like.
That's so he was a serious team there. Like.
He played Cork once upon a time as well.
But it finished in 2004.
We had a psychiatrist on the podcast for Dr. Bessel van der Kolk. I was telling you about him. He's an expert in PTSD and his book, The Body Keeps the Score, he writes a lot about victims of sexual violence and rape. And he said that sometimes they can find it very difficult to be intimate and leave themselves vulnerable with men in the future. Did you find that difficult?
I suppose, look, I'll be honest and I'll open up and I hope Mark won't mind me. He won't mind me saying this, but, you know, Mark would have woken up to me shouting and screaming in my sleep. And I suppose it was at a time where I was very insecure, but Mark brought trust back into my life, where I could start trusting again, and having fun again, and to be able to go out into town and smile.
You have a big smile.
And be happy, and be confident in myself. And he used to say, "Fuck them all," you know.
That's a typical Norrie quote,
isn't it?
Fuck them all.
He's an awful man on the pitch, though. He hates referees.
Oh, that's wrong. But you know what it's like? It's like, you know, the Rosalind that you wore before the event, that kind of happy, free spirit, smiley, positive outlook. And then when the captain relayed back to you the rape, and then you said you lost that.
Yeah.
It sounds like Mark brought that, started bringing that back into your life a little bit.
He did, because he loved me, I suppose.
Yeah.
Sure, why wouldn't you?
Exactly.
I know. No, he did. Again, it took a long time to gain trust and friendship and, you know, like throughout the years, like my moods were... The depression was still there, you know, whereas, oh God, there was times, lads, where I would just get up in the morning for the sake of getting up, okay, and taking the kids to school, and I'd hop back into bed, just sleep. And I get up again before the kids come home from school or even from Mark coming back from work, you know. So it's tough. I do go through those periods of highs and lows.
Yeah.
At any point during this, did you ever go to your doctor and did he ever help you with maybe medication? Because medication can be very helpful to people as well suffering with depression.
Yeah. Oh, I had to. PTSD. Got to the point. Yeah, I had to. The panic attacks, the anxiety, I never experienced. Like, it was so bad where your heart is just, your mind is taking over and you have the worst thoughts. And your heart is just racing and you're trying to... I just went to bed just... And these cold shivers. Do you ever get these cold shivers through you in bed?
Yeah.
And that's a fight or flight issue as well.
Yeah.
You know, there's something happening and you're trying to control it. But you need to ground yourself. But yeah.
Do you know what it reminded me of? Do you know, when I was in active addiction, if I was after, sometimes if I was after a big drugs binge or alcohol binge or both for a few days and then go to sleep after a few days of being up, I'd often get this recurring dream. It's more of a night terror.
Yeah.
Where
yeah.
there's men standing over me in the bed. I can't move. I'm trying to scream, but nothing is coming out. It's the realest thing ever.
That happened to me.
But
yeah.
I can, like, it's not real. You know, you wake up out of it and then you realise, fucking hell,
these,
that was like, just the night.
These monsters coming at you.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
You know?
But I'm trying to imagine, like if that happened, but it was actually real, that yeah. happened. When you wake up, that actually happened, you know, and it's terrifying. Do you know what I mean?
And
do you know, you mentioned briefly Women of Honour. Is that a group of women that have had similar experience with yourself?
Yes. So we were a group of women who I suppose, exposed to misogyny and sexual abuse, sexual assault, bullying, harassment within our Irish Defence Forces. That's to include the Army, the Naval Service and the Air Corps.
And do you know, when you spoke up, or even before that, to your knowledge, was the person that raped you responsible for more rapes? Did you ever connect with other girls or women?
Yes, there was a woman connected with me through Facebook a few years ago to say that she had been assaulted by the same rapist who raped me, and in similar circumstances to my own, very similar to my own. And again, she was sidelined like myself. I put up my hand, but I was sidelined, and so was she. And to this day, I suppose to this day, the response of the Defence Forces and the response of her reporting her assault has been nothing but shameful.
So do you know that that man, he's just, there's been people that's been covering up for him and moving him around.
I can't answer that, James. I don't know. But I can't answer it, James. Yeah. I don't know.
I suppose it's just a theory I'm forming in my own head. It's like, it's that just two women now that don't know each other with the same allegation. Like, at what stage do you think it can't be always other people's fault? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
At
some
stage, the army have to say, look, maybe this guy is, you know, bad news.
They all knew that he was bad news. But no one would speak up. They're all protecting their own careers as well.
Yeah.
And their own pensions.
And he's probably quite senior. Probably have a lot of senior connections. If he's probably in there so long.
Well, he's not serving now. Okay. No, he's not serving. I'm 45, 46 next month, believe it or not.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And do you know what? James is actually disgusted because Rosalind, when she came in, she thought James was about 46.
Well,
I got the younger age, and everybody knows that James always tells everybody that he's the younger one. But someone actually says, James, you actually look older than Timmy.
And know what she said to Timmy? She says, you're muscly, but you're small.
Yeah, that was a joke, no, in fairness.
No, it's the truth.
Nah, fuck. I'm not going to talk. And you know, you're not getting a hug on me.
Yeah.
So what's life like for you now?
Very good. Yeah. I have three kids. I have a husband. I'm stay-at-home mom. So that's fairly busy. That's a full-time job in itself.
Yeah.
I'm a bloody taxi service to my not to my youngest, but to the other two. Jesus. And I'm a bank to them as well.
Personal ATM.
Personal ATM. Even though they'd have their own money, you know. And if we went to shop the other day now, and I said, Colin, are you going to pay for that? No, you've your own money, you know. Yeah. You know, but he's 16, Cullen's 16, and Cliona's 19. So Cliona's going to second year in UCC.
Yeah.
Do you know what I heard? Do you know Revolut? That was invented by teenagers.
I believe it.
I'm telling you now, because all I get is requests.
Yeah.
Text messages from requests from the kids.
Yeah.
So it was definitely invented by teenagers,
you know, and
so they could fleece their mother and fathers.
Yeah.
And guilt trip then.
Oh.
You're getting the guilt trip. Yeah. The emotion.
Yeah. I can't keep up with them at all. Yeah. And I have work ethos. You know, you go out and you work for your money.
Yeah.
You work hard. and you enjoy life, then the benefits of having money, you know. So, but Colin works in Shidani Hotel now, so nice. I'm a taxi service in and out and out.
We might get an old rate off you, you know, and vote your
call. I told him he needs handover, €20 every Friday morning. I'm still waiting.
he might get us an old corporate rate to me, don't
know. Oh, jeez,
we talk about that off,
we will,
thanks for your time, Rosalind. It was a pleasure speaking to you.
Thank you so much.
A pleasure.
And you know, before we finish up, maybe if you just put something to you, like if there was any women or girls listening now that might have had a similar experience but haven't told anybody, or maybe looking for support but don't know where to go, have you any kind of bit of wisdom for them?
I do. You are not alone. Do not feel ashamed. Do not hide your pain, because it will eat away at you. Speak up. Go to someone. There's always someone that listens. There are kind, good, decent people out there. We all have issues. Everybody has issues. Do not be afraid.
Yeah.
Talk to someone. And you will be guided and you will be supported. And no matter how small you might think the issue is or how big the issue is, talk to someone. That's all I can say, lads, because you know, in today's society, women should know, women have voices just like men have voices, and we need to be heard.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Thanks, Rosalind.
Thanks,
and we leave the details of some support services in the description of this podcast.
Yes.
So thanks a million, Rosalind.
Thanks a million.
We'll see everybody next week. God bless.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.